perfect control of the match, my rhythm and movements are excellent, and everything's just in total balance. It's a perfect combination of a violent action taking place in an atmosphere of total tranquility. And when it happens, I want to stop the match, grab the microphone and shout, "That's what it's all about." But it's not just for athletes. Brain surgeons, trial lawyers, school teachers, musicians, stay-at-home moms and dads can experience transcendence as well. In fact, it can happen to one degree or another to anyone. Like when you hug your newborn child and time slips away. Or when you connect deeply with a beloved partner and you are enveloped in a moment that seems to last forever. It's the kid in the backyard shooting hoops when magically, when no one is looking, he or she hits 10 impossible jump shots in a row. Swish, swish, swish. Or the author who's been battling writer's block suddenly finds all the right words flowing, page after page. These are glimpses of the zone or transcendence. Different experiences at different times, but all sharing the commonality of action infused with silence. Effortless, timeless, and satisfying way beyond the norm. The important thing is it starts from inside. You take note of these moments because they are meaningful and indescribably fulfilling. Some of the greatest poets have done justice to the experience. The closest description I've seen in writing is William Wordsworth's Lines Composed a Few Miles Above Tintern Abbey. That serene and blessed mood in which the affections gently lead us on until the breath of this corporeal frame and even the motion of our human blood, almost suspended, we are laid asleep in body and become a living soul, while with an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and the deep power of joy, we see into the life of things. But for the rest of us non-poets, transcendence can be a challenge to put into words. What does it feel like? It's like trying to describe happiness in words. Or telling someone who has never eaten a kiwi what it tastes like. No, it doesn't exactly taste like an orange or a peach or a strawberry. Well, the bright green flesh has a juicy texture and a sweetness, and the tiny seeds within can add just the slightest grit. But really, you'll never fully convey the experience precisely through words. The kiwi must be experienced firsthand. The transcendental meditation technique has many purposes. Reduce stress, clear the mind, raise performance. But foremost among them is to experience transcendence. And not on rare once or twice in a lifetime occasions, but whenever you want, to one degree or another, every day. Does it always feel like the ways that Billie Jean King or William Wordsworth describe? Of course not. Sometimes the experience in meditation is profound. Oftentimes it can seem mundane. But each time you meditate, even if your mind is filled with a million thoughts, you do settle down toward levels of the mind that are deeper, quieter, more satisfying. And when you do that, the equanimity you experience during meditation naturally comes out to be lived more and more in every moment of your life. And that is a very good description of the zone. Meditative moment. I love energy. Jerry Seinfeld started TM in 1972 when he was 18. In 2009, we met backstage for the first time at Radio City Music Hall in New York City during a benefit concert for the David Lynch Foundation, to raise the funds to teach 1 million at-risk youth around the world to meditate. We connected, remained friends, and the next thing I knew, several years had passed, and I was at his home on Long Island teaching his family to meditate. We were all hanging out in the kitchen one day, and Jerry mentioned that he meditates every afternoon. I asked about his morning meditation. He gave me a quizzical look and said he'd only been meditating once a day. But smart guy that he is, he suddenly realized that maybe he was getting only half the benefits, maybe even less. In his unique Seinfeldian way, he recently shared what doubling his daily TM sessions did for him. This is what Jerry told me. I stopped doing my morning TM pretty early because I didn't understand the value of getting out of bed and then resting. I had trouble with that concept. Get out of bed, now meditate, and rest some more. But I was very regular with my afternoon meditation. Then I started doing the television series in which I was the star of the show, the executive producer, and head writer. I did casting and editing for 22 to 24 episodes per season on network television for 9 years. That's a lot of work. And I'm pretty much a regular guy. I'm not one of those crazy people who have endless, boundless energy. So I'm a normal guy, but that was not a normal situation. Every day, when everybody would have lunch, I would meditate. Then we'd go back to work, and I would eat afterward. That was how I survived the 9 years. Those 20 minutes of TM in the middle of the day saved me. Now, I know everybody's life is hard, and every job is hard. But when it's your name on the show, the pressure's intense. The show got successful, and everybody expected each week for the show to be better than the last. I loved every second, but it was a lot of pressure and a lot of work, and I never could have accomplished it without TM. But remember, I was meditating only once a day. When you reminded me about the morning meditation, it changed everything. I'm a 63-year-old guy with little kids, and now because of TM, I'm functioning at a level I really didn't think was possible for someone my age. I get up at 6 in the morning and meditate before my kids get up to have breakfast. I like watching them eat cereal, and I like the little milk dribbling down their chins. When I tell people I meditate, they ask me how it feels. It doesn't feel like much of anything. I don't understand it either. But here's the difference. At 1 o'clock later that day, I'm no longer shot. My head doesn't hit the desk like it used to. Being a writer is a big part of being a comedian, and writing is a very exhaustive activity. I used to literally collapse in the middle of writing and have to lie on the couch and take a nap. Now at 1 o'clock, I'm feeling good from my morning meditation 7 hours earlier. I just sail through the day, and I have my second TM at 3 or 4 in the afternoon. The unfortunate thing about being a lifelong meditator is there's no control group to look at what would have happened if I didn't do it. But I do know I'm a lot better when I'm not exhausted, and I love energy. I pursue it. I want it. I think this is the reason I'm so enthusiastic about TM. I also know that had I been meditating twice a day all these years, Seinfeld would still be on the air. Pillar 2. Day 1. Starting the process. Let's get to it. The Transcendental Meditation Technique is taught over 4 consecutive days, about 90 minutes each day. What happens in each of those sessions? First, after you decide you want to learn, but before you take the first step to be taught in personal instruction, you'll meet with a TM teacher for a few minutes to ask any questions you might have about the practice. To better prepare the teacher to instruct you, you will be asked to fill out a simple 1-page interview form. The questions are pretty basic. Your reasons for wanting to learn TM, your overall mood and state of health, whether you sleep well at night, what previous experience you've had, if any, with other forms of meditation. Your answers to these straightforward questions are helpful for your teacher in providing you with personalized instruction. Also during this initial meeting, your teacher will talk about the tradition of great meditation teachers who have safeguarded the knowledge of transcendence for millennia, and about the traditional way a TM teacher acknowledges this lineage of teachers today. Prior to the instruction, your teacher will perform a simple thank you ceremony, an ancient way of expressing gratitude to the teacher. It's a lovely cultural tradition, and not religious in any way. It also reminds your teacher to maintain the integrity and accuracy of the steps of instruction to ensure maximum benefit for those who learn in the future. You won't, of course, be asked to participate in it. The thank you includes a few flowers, some fresh fruit, a candle, a stick of incense, and to represent the tradition of meditation teachers, a picture of Maharishi's teacher, Gurudev. I have instructed many hundreds of devoutly religious people of all faiths, and when I describe the ceremony, some initially think it could be religious. But when I explain its purpose, they appreciate it. To honor one's teacher like this is rare in our modern world, but not altogether unfamiliar. One cardiologist I taught said it was similar to the Hippocratic oath he took in preparation to becoming a doctor. I instructed a tough-as-nails military officer, and he told me that he found it extremely touching. It reminded him of the honor ceremonies he took part in as a young cadet at his academy. Sometimes students try to read something into the thank you ceremony. One recently asked me to comment on the significance of why white tulips were used that day. "They look fresh at the store," I said with a smile. It's that straightforward. Once you are satisfied that all of your questions have been answered, you'll be escorted to a private room, much like a small conference room in a doctor's office. You sit comfortably in a chair across from your teacher. It's a place of calm quiet with no music or unnecessary trappings. After your teacher says thank you to the tradition, he or she will give you your mantra. Its sole purpose is to serve as a vehicle for transcending, one that allows your busy, active mind to settle down to its own deepest level, the source of thought. It's important that the mantra has no meaning associated with it. Why? Because if it meant something, you'd be stuck on the superficial gotta, gotta, gotta level of the mind, trying to explore different avenues of meaning. Then you won't settle down. You won't transcend. You won't meditate. It's also important that the effects of the mantra are known to exert a positive influence. Why? Because any sound, positive or negative, has a powerful influence on the brain and the rest of the nervous system. Remember the sound of fingernails scraping across a chalkboard? Awful. As a TM teacher, I want to be sure that the mantra you are using to meditate will have only positive, life-supporting effects on your mind and body, both on the surface level of thinking, but also on the deeper, more powerful levels of the mind. The mantras have been time-tested over thousands of years, and the effects have been documented by hundreds of studies. Both confirm that TM is beneficial and safe. In fact, there has never been any study published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal that has shown any negative impact, only positive. People I teach naturally ask how I choose the mantra. I liken the selection to that of a medical doctor who has specialized training in how to identify a person's blood type, whether it is, for example, type A, B, or O. With TM, the selection of the mantra is based on three things. First, the information you filled out on your interview form. Second, the personal meeting you had with a TM teacher. And third, your TM teacher's own comprehensive certification training. All this ensures that you will be given the mantra that is best suited for you, and then, importantly, you will be taught how to use it properly. Receiving your mantra is only part of the instruction and takes only a few minutes. The rest of the instruction on day one and the following 3 days involves learning how to meditate, how to use the mantra properly, without effort, concentration, or control. Some people who hear about TM in a casual way think, "Just give me the mantra and I'll figure out how to use it." That misses the point. The mantra is not like taking a pill. The mantra alone does nothing. You could have the best car in the world, but if you don't know how to drive it, you won't go anywhere. You need both, the car and the training to drive. A big misconception about the mantra is that you have to repeat it over and over to drive out thoughts. That's not transcendental meditation. Here the mantra serves as a vehicle to lead the mind to the source of thought. Learning how to use the mantra properly is a simple but very individual experience. You're learning how to access the deepest core of your own being. A teacher works with you and only you in the initial session. There's a lot of back and forth, a lot of questions and answers, and then you'll get it, and you will get it, even if you think you'll be the only person in the world who won't. But what does it feel like to meditate? Physically, it's very relaxing. Mentally, it's calming yet awakening and deeply satisfying. Many people tell me that time passes quickly. The adage, time flies when you're having a good time, is true. There's usually a double take when they ask how long they've been meditating. Felt like 5 minutes, they'll say. A frequent question is, how do I sit? The answer is, comfortably. As I said earlier, there's no particular way to sit and no specific way to position your hands. Do you need to stretch your legs or shift positions in the middle of the meditation? Do it. Nor do you need any special type of chair. In my office, students sit on folding chairs, easy chairs, or a sofa. Just use a chair you like, whatever is available. Trust me, at one time or another, you'll find yourself meditating in a taxi cab or on a train or plane. It works fine. I've even meditated at Yankee Stadium. It was an amazing confluence of two loves, meditation and baseball. Noise is no obstacle to transcending. You will also learn simple best practices that seem obvious but aren't, such as, it's best to turn off your cell phone when you meditate, and don't meditate right after drinking a double espresso or eating a burrito. By the way, there's good logic here. Caffeine and digesting a burrito both raise your metabolic rate, and when you meditate, your body wants to rest. Deeply. I know. I tried to do both. That didn't work out so well. This one-to-one session with your teacher clarifies the mechanics so you feel completely comfortable with the practice and get the absolute maximum out of your 20-minute meditation. You will leave ready to learn and experience more. Meditative moment. Like taking your mind to a spa. Donna Rockwell is a Renaissance woman, a clinical psychologist and a mindfulness teacher, who started her career as a producer and a reporter covering Capitol Hill for the fledgling CNN. She started TM recently as a compliment to her 20-year dogged commitment to practicing mindfulness. I was interested in what she thought of both practices, and we talked a few months into her new experience. This is what Donna said. When I first got into mindfulness, I went to a teacher who was very involved with Shambhala meditation. He gave me mindful awareness meditation instructions, and I was supposed to sit there with him for 5 minutes. Within 30 seconds, I thought my head was going to pop off. I couldn't do it for the life of me. I saw how type A I was, and I was so disturbed that I had no stillness whatsoever that I then completely dedicated myself to the practice of meditation. For me, mindfulness has been a boot camp training of reining in the tendency of the mind to wander. You notice that tendency to wander, and albeit very tenderly, you work to bring the mind back. There's this notion that the mind is somehow a wild horse that is constantly bucking in a very small corral. The goal of mindfulness is to make that corral larger and create a wide open pasture in which to train the mind to come back to the present moment. After 20 years of practicing mindfulness, I'm better trained to be in the here and now, because all of my hours and hours and weekends and days of just sitting in one spot and looking at a dot on the floor. I am better able to activate my brain's prefrontal cortex and have an awareness that I'm having amygdala stimulation. But now that I've added TM to my practice, it's a completely different thing. While I think mindfulness is mind training, TM is more like taking the mind to an amazing spa. From the very first time, it felt like my brain was settling into a nice, warm bath. My brain calms down and gets back to a state of homeostasis. And then after 20 minutes, I return to my life with greater peace and well-being. I think the practices beautifully complement each other. Granted, mindfulness is not 20 minutes. When you go on a mindfulness retreat, you sit for 40 minutes, then you walk for 10, more or less. Then you sit for another 40 minutes, then you walk for 10, then you sit for 40 minutes, you get up again, all the while becoming aware of wandering thoughts and coming back to the present moment. Like I said, boot camp. TM says, you've worked so hard all these years to be a more enlightened person. Now here's a meditation practice where you can simply sit for 20 minutes and become naturally refreshed by allowing the mind to settle down. Yes, you think the mantra, but you don't have to strain about it. Your mind goes where it wants to go, towards something more satisfying. Then after TM's 20-minute mental spa treatment, I return to my day revitalized and ready for what awaits. Day 2. Points of correct practice. This second day of instruction, and the next two classes as well, usually take place in small groups with others who learned to meditate the day before. It's a time to discuss what you experienced while meditating on your own, either at home or work. It's also valuable for your own practice to talk with others who are learning how to meditate. These sessions are held at your local TM center or, if you are learning as part of a wellness program at your school or business, on site there. This is an opportunity for your teacher to refresh the correct mechanics of TM practice, how not to concentrate or control your mind, something you might have learned from other techniques. The class is also about reassurance. The process is so natural, so effortless, for many people it almost seems too good to be true. It can even raise doubts. One of the first things people say is, "That's great. It's so easy. Could I possibly be doing this right?" Yes, you are. It is that easy. I remind everyone that every meditation will be different, because your body is different each time you sit to meditate. But you will know you are meditating properly in these beginning days if 1, it's easy to do, 2, you feel some deep relaxation during the practice, and 3, you feel a sense of well-being afterward. Nothing flashy, but nonetheless, its cumulative impact on your life will be significant. During this session, your teacher will also talk with you about the finer points of the practice. You will be encouraged to meditate twice a day. The first meditation is in the morning before breakfast. This allows the slower brain waves of sleep to shift naturally to the faster, more wakeful, and coherent alpha-1 brain waves of deep meditation. Your morning meditation gives you the greater energy and resilience, so you don't take on as much stress during the day. The second meditation is best done in the late afternoon or early evening, before dinner if possible. You rid your body of much of the stresses that accumulate during the day so that you're better able to be present and available for the people you love in the evening. Plus, you will sleep better at night and wake up feeling fresher in the morning. That said, it's not ideal to meditate right before bed. TM does produce a deep state of rest, but it's also quite energizing, so you may not be able to fall asleep following a late-night meditation. People ask how they will know when the 20 minutes of the meditation are up. I smile and say, look at your watch. This is not hypnosis. You're not in a zone. You're just settling down physically and mentally while remaining wide awake inside. Many people find that within a few days of learning TM, the body's internal clock somehow knows exactly when 20 minutes is up, within a minute or so. But whatever you do, please don't set an alarm. It can be incredibly jarring. Plus, you'll have to turn it off. People also ask, what if I fall asleep? I say, good, sleep. If you fall asleep during meditation, it's healthy, it's revitalizing. It will just be for a minute or two. And it's not some superficial catnap. It's a deep rest that helps to heal and rejuvenate the body. Meditative moment. Meet some of my friends. I know a lot of highly competitive men and women who love to proclaim, almost defiantly, I love stress. I couldn't live without it. They have relied on their edge for so long that they don't think they can continue to do their work effectively without it. Yes, they may love negotiating a deal that leaves their client doing a victory lap, but they won't love the tension headache that goes with it, or the hours of lost sleep because they can't switch off their brain at night, or the lack of mental space they have to devote to their loved ones. These problems, some just a nuisance, others signs of something possibly serious developing, can markedly impact your health and performance over time. Meditating doesn't mean that life's unexpected challenges and obstacles suddenly disappear. It does mean, however, that you will be better equipped to take on those challenges with greater energy, focus, and resilience. You can lessen the effects of stress and still have those same victories for yourself and your clients. Take my friend Rick Goings, who has been the CEO of Tupperware Brands Corporation since 1992. He's a veteran who was a Navy petty officer in the Vietnam era and remains incredibly youthful in his early 70s. Rick is, frankly, the last guy you'd peg as passive, and he meditates each and every day. "I always talk with our people about how you can decide how you're going to approach life," he said. "You can either be a warrior or a victim. And you know, too many people are victims. Poor me, poor this, poor that." Transcendental meditation, Rick told me, prepares him to conquer those setbacks. "Bad stuff happens in life," he said. "The key word is responsibility. It isn't a heavy word. It just means owning your ability to respond to situations outside of your control. You know how every sport has a ready position? TM helps keep me in a ready position for life." Another student of mine is Bill Konigsberg, founder and CEO of Horizon Media, the largest and fastest-growing privately held media services agency in the world. The agency, which Bill founded in 1989, is consistently recognized as one of the best places to work in the industry, and Bill is the only person to ever win the prestigious Advertising Age Media Maven Award twice. He's been making deals since he was 14 when he managed tennis courts. He's a great, generous guy, and he's tremendously busy, and he was one of those people who thought he didn't have the time to meditate. "I was a total skeptic," he told me. 20 minutes, twice a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year? Could I actually do that? How on earth do you have the time?" But he accepted the challenge, carving out time by waking 25 minutes earlier than normal. 3 years into his practice, he says, "It's just part of my routine now. I can do it in a car. I can do it on a plane. I close the door for 20 minutes in my office and go do it. And if I don't do it, I feel that I've missed out on something very special." That's Bill as an individual. But remember that in business, relationships are everything. Early on in his meditation practice, Horizon's head of human resources told Bill what an impact TM was making on him. Bill recalled her saying, "You're so much calmer, more patient, more present, you're less reactive, and your perspective seems so much more balanced and assertive in a thoughtful way. Your meditation is good for everyone." Bill told me, "I didn't even think of myself as an overly aggressive person, but I guess that says in a nutshell what it did for me in a short period of time." Bill is so impressed by the results for himself that he plans to offer it to his employees. For Marilyn Frobacino, finding the time to meditate is not an option, it's a necessity. As an executive chef, she has run award-winning restaurants in New York City and was head chef at the Soho Grand Hotel and a J.P. Morgan Chase & Company in Manhattan. Marilyn, who has practiced TM for 2 years, now works as a private chef, an incredibly demanding and time-consuming job. She told me, "When you're a private chef, you make 21 different meals each week. You have to be extremely flexible and deal with other people's changing schedules and dietary needs. I always had a low-level anxiety that was job-related," she said. "Beyond creating menus and competition with other chefs, every day I had to prove myself as a woman in my industry. Whether it was to a general manager, or a new food and beverage rep, or a restaurant manager, there was always that level of stress, anxiety, and competition. Since I've been meditating, I feel I manage all of it better. I have to, because I know that stress just builds on itself. And if I don't have an outlet, it just accumulates." I know the realities of work life. Your day is so packed you eat lunch at your desk or during a meeting. But some of the busiest people I know find ways to get in their 20 minutes in the morning and the afternoon. Maybe not always, of course, but most always. For the morning one, they get up 20 minutes earlier. It's more rejuvenating than sleep, so it's not that difficult. Plus, since they're sleeping better, 20 minutes less sleep is not the end of the world. For the afternoon, I know a lot of people who schedule it as a regular appointment in their daily calendar, as they would an important meeting. If your office or home is not an ideal place for meditation, you can slip out to a public space, like a park bench or even a church. Remember, you don't have to be in a completely quiet space to meditate. You can do it pretty much anywhere. It isn't just the demands of work that make people think they won't be able to stick to a twice-a-day regimen. It's the demands of home life as well. Many parents of young children wonder if it's realistic to make time to meditate on a daily basis. Tell moms or dads, hey, just get up 20 minutes earlier, and they roll their eyes and say their kids will probably just do the same. For some, evenings can be a challenge because parents have been conditioned to make the most of every moment with their kids. I deeply appreciate the difficulties, but meditation is vitally important, and parents should do the best they can. When parents take time out to meditate, they're sending an important message to their kids that a few minutes of rest and rejuvenation in the midst of an impossibly busy day is not an indulgence, but rather an essential component of a healthy, productive lifestyle. You're making meditation a priority in your life, and your kids will carry that lesson with them for the rest of their lives. Whenever I hear from a parent, "I just don't have time, my kids won't let me," I think of Catherine, a single mom I met a few years back. Catherine told me when she first started to meditate, "I knew I could do my 20-minute meditation in the morning before the kids wake up, but I can't meditate at work, and my bus ride home is too short, so my big concern is, what will I do in the evening once I get home? How am I going to check their homework, fix dinner, talk about their day, be present, and meditate? I multitask while brushing my teeth." "Call me in 2 weeks," I said. 2 weeks went by, and sure enough, Catherine was on the line. "I'm doing it twice a day," she said proudly. "What happened?" I asked. She laughed. "My kids happened. Now when I get home and I start snapping at them about homework or dinner, they say, 'Mommy, have you meditated?' Because they know that if they give me the time, they will get their mom back. And not the stressed-out mom, but the more patient, present, loving mom." That's exactly right. It's not narcissistic to meditate. And it's definitely not just, "Well, leave mommy alone for 20 minutes. The children get back a mother who's not carrying frustrations and fatigue from the day. They get an even better parent who's not just going through the motions of being present because it's a checkbox on that laundry list of responsibilities. And they see someone modeling self-care and resilience. Because really, the world is as you are. If you are stressed, wound tight, exhausted, consumed by worry, then all of your relationships at work and home are going to be affected, meaning more contentiousness and less satisfaction. But if you are strong and connected within yourself, and you naturally have a lot to give, you won't be expecting a partner or a child to make you happy all the time. You won't come home or go to work with a chip on your shoulder. You won't enter a negotiation with your amygdala doing the thinking, itching for a fight. You will make decisions with a healthy brain. Maharishi put it this way: if the individual has fully developed potential, he'll enjoy friendships, relationships, and marriage to the fullest extent. Therefore, the key to relationships is to take care of our own self. We meditate, and then our potentiality is being used more and more through practice. And then a time will come when we are using our full potential, and we will have a fully developed heart and mind. And with a fully developed heart and mind, all relationships will be enjoyed just because we are able to give maximum of ourselves to others. Meditative moment. Time with Your True Self. I first met the incredibly talented Hugh Jackman and his equally extraordinary wife, Deborah Lee Furness, when I taught TM to their son, Oscar, who showed an interest in meditation at a young age. I actually started calling him Oscar Yogi because he is just preternaturally wise. As a 12-year-old, he and I would have long conversations about anthropology, history, religion, philosophy. It was hard for me to keep up. Hugh had learned to meditate while in drama school in Australia, but he and Deborah Lee relearned with me. Hugh told me, "I'm of the school that you should always be ready to learn something. TM has really helped. I'm someone who is diligent and disciplined. A lot of people get stuck on the idea of meditating twice a day. I didn't get stuck on that, but there was this little bit of a shadow of a thought, this is good for me. I should do this. I've got to meditate," which is exactly the thing you're trying to get away from in meditation, that gotta mind. I've got to meditate. I've got to wake up so I can meditate. So when I learned with Bob, that completely went away. That idea of giving myself a hard time about it, stressing if I fell asleep or if my mind was going nonstop, all those judgments about it really went away. There's a level of stress to my job that is easy to buy into. You don't necessarily know what is coming up next month or next year. Doesn't matter how long you're doing it, each new role or new job you do, whether it's hosting or an acting role or film or theater, there's some element about it that's risky, that's frightening, that can bring stress. It's also a good thing because creatively, it's healthy to have a sense of the unknown as I try something I haven't done before. It kind of brings things out of yourself that surprise you. But I used to find that stress difficult to cope with. I would internalize it. My wife used to say, after I completed something I was nervous about, "Oh, good, I got my husband back." I was not fully there because a part of my brain, a big part or a small part, depending on the job, was concentrating on what was going to happen. For me, the best way to handle that has been meditation. So, of course, I meditated before I hosted the Oscars. I meditate before I go on stage. I meditate in the morning and lunchtime when I'm on a film set. It's like a reset. I'm not saying I'm never frightened anymore and that I don't have stress, but I like the analogy of a glass of water. When you first pour it, it's cloudy. When you're stressed, that's what your mind is like. It's kind of cloudy. And after I meditate, all that sinks to the bottom, and the water is clear, and the energy is finer, and the decisions you make are more authentic. I think you're more economical with your energy, with your time, in every way. You're more able to listen to other people, and as an actor, that's what you've got. The only tools I really have are being present, being clear, and listening. When I meditate, I'm joining my true self, which is this calm, peaceful, blissful, limitless self. I can then parlay that into any situation. When I walk out of a car on a red carpet and there's 3,000 people cheering, deep down, actually, I'm connecting with their calm inner self. It's not that I don't get excited or that I don't enjoy life or that I don't go crazy sometimes. I have fun, but there's always one thought a little outside going, "This is fun, but really it's all calm." And that's how meditation has helped. It doesn't matter what situation I'm in, people say, "Oh, you're so down to earth." No, it's just that meditation makes me see what's true and real. Day 3. Success without stress. On this third day of instruction, I talk about the impact of stress on life and the mechanics of how the TM technique helps to neutralize its buildup. Believe it or not, stress has not always been the enemy. I know that statement might sound ridiculous given what I've said about the dangers of stress, but for much of our 200,000-year human history, our stress response system was one of the body's most important survival tools. Let's jump back to when your ancestors were hunters having a normal day in the savannas of Africa. They'd be walking along and suddenly find themselves eye to eye with a lion. Without conscious thought, they either dug in their heels and gripped their spears, or they turned and ran for their sweet lives. That is why we still have what's called the fight or flight response. Back then, if you saw a lion or heard the roar, that information went to your amygdala, the little almond-shaped set of nerve cells or neurons deep in your brain. The amygdala is the fire alarm that tells your body it's under attack. When a human is under stress, two hormones, the chemical messengers cortisol and epinephrine, which is also known as adrenaline, flood the bloodstream in a lightning-quick process. Today, if we are already in a high state of stress and anxiety, the lion on the savannah can be a child throwing a temper tantrum right before school, a major traffic jam blocking your way to a critical meeting, a high-stakes exam for a calculus class tomorrow morning, or an elderly parent suffering from late-stage Alzheimer's disease. When you have experiences like that, often repeatedly, you might shorthand it and say, "I am really stressed." It's hard to know what will set us off. I know a woman who's a principal soloist with one of the world's most celebrated opera companies. I mentioned to her that performing before thousands of people in a grand concert hall night after night must be incredibly stressful. She said, "Oh, that's easy. It's the train ride getting to the concert hall that stresses me out." Life is filled with inevitable external demands, challenges, illnesses, and so on. Science calls these stressors. Financial stressors, family stressors, job stressors, social stressors. You can try to manage or minimize stressors, but the truth is they will always be there. And these days it seems like we have little or no control over most of them. The real issue is how we react to those stressors. This is what scientists call our stress response. If we are well rested, thinking clearly, and on top of our game, we meet those stressors head on. And afterwards we feel good, invigorated, satisfied, ready for the next challenge. But if we're not sleeping well, not thinking particularly clearly, and feeling off, we get overwhelmed. We get stressed. According to research, stress hits us in at least three distinct, often debilitating ways. On the muscular or structural level, we become tense. Tension affects different people in different ways. Some develop tension headaches and a stiff neck and shoulders, or their jaw tightens up, or they grind their teeth at night, or their stomach knots up, or they get back pain, or their blood vessels constrict, which means less oxygen reaches the brain or heart, and that increases the likelihood of a stroke or heart attack. The list goes on and on. Second, on the level of cognitive functioning, reduced circulation to the brain skews its electrical activity, taking key parts of the brain offline. In particular, stress can shut down the prefrontal cortex, which functions as the brain's CEO. The prefrontal cortex is about the size of your fist and sits right behind your forehead. It takes in all the information, motor, sensory, and so forth, from the outside world transmitted to it from other areas of the brain and helps you decide your next moves. The prefrontal cortex governs executive functioning, judgment, problem-solving, ethical reasoning, and your sense of self. And let me add this. The prefrontal cortex is not integrated with the rest of the brain of a teenager. In fact, the connections between the prefrontal cortex and the rest of the brain are not completed until the middle or late 20s, often even later in life. That's why teenagers frequently don't consider the consequences of risky behaviors, and maybe why you can't rent a car until you're 25. With the CEO offline, the amygdala takes over the command of the brain. That's a good thing if a lion is about to attack you, because the amygdala is the fight or flight or emergency center of the brain. But it's not good if your amygdala goes ballistic while you're stuck in traffic. If the prefrontal cortex is the calm, rational, creative, insightful CEO, your amygdala is the hyperreactive, paid-by-the-hour security guard itching for a fight. It deals only with crises, with an impending attack, with the most urgent matters at hand. It's a yes to instantaneous reactions, to punch and counterpunch. It's a no to long-term planning, seeing the big picture, pausing to reflect. Foresight and compassion are not in the amygdala's job description. With chronic stress, you're chronically acting from that fear center. Do you make good decisions when you're stressed? Display sound judgment? Solve problems? Plan well? Of course not. With a hyper-aroused amygdala, you overreact to just about everything. You don't think as clearly, your memory is less reliable, you get sick more often, and you just don't feel like yourself. The third component is that our stress response stimulates the adrenal gland atop each kidney to secrete too much cortisol, now popularly known as the stress hormone. This feeds anxiety, and then the adrenals pump out more cortisol, which makes us even more anxious. Stress has turned our bodies into walking cortisol factories. Elevated cortisol destroys healthy muscle and bone, slows healing and normal cell regeneration, co-opts biochemicals needed to make other vital hormones, impairs digestion, metabolism, and mental function, and weakens the immune system. It also affects your most basic functions, such as memory. It's why you can't remember people's names in a job interview, or why you check the address for a date 3 times. Cortisol also stimulates your appetite, which of course increases your weight. Finally, it has an adverse effect on your sleep. Cortisol suppresses your body's production of the hormone melatonin, which is integral to your sleep cycle. Troubled sleep can be a real killer. Organizational psychologist Carrie Cooper, a leading authority on workplace stress, opined in an interview that stress is the black plague of the 21st century. For many people, modern medicine offers little to prevent stress and often has nothing to cure it. Norman Rosenthal is a Georgetown University School of Medicine clinical professor of psychiatry, a medical researcher, and the author of the books Winter Blues, Everything You Need to Know to Beat Seasonal Affective Disorder, and Supermind, How to Boost Performance and Live a Richer and Happier Life Through Transcendental Meditation. As a senior researcher for 20 years at the National Institute of Mental Health, Dr. Rosenthal was the first to describe seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, and prescribe light therapy as a treatment. Dr. Rosenthal has been practicing TM for 8 years, and in his private practice, he sees people from all walks of life who come to him with many different concerns. But one theme that runs through all of their worries is stress, its impact on their lives, and their struggle to find ways to deal with it more effectively. Dr. Rosenthal told me, "After discovering the value of TM to me personally, I began to recommend it to my patients and clients, many of whom now practice it regularly. In almost 40 years as a psychiatrist, transcendental meditation stands out as one of the most powerful and effective techniques I have ever encountered for reducing stress." I want to shift gears here and take a moment to talk in some detail about some of the truly breakthrough research documenting the unique and profound benefits TM has on stress and health. It's common knowledge that two of the biggest killers in developed countries are heart attack, which is a myocardial infarction, and stroke, two conditions that are often the direct result of damaged arteries from stress. Arteries are the pipes that carry oxygenated blood pumped by the heart to all the tissues in our bodies. When their linings are damaged or blocked, as occurs in a condition called atherosclerosis, blood cannot get through in adequate amounts. And then you're talking about a heart attack or stroke, which will either disable you or end your life. In addition, when stress occurs continuously, blood pressure levels become elevated even at rest. And because there are often no warning symptoms associated with raised blood pressure, the condition has aptly been called the silent killer. In the United States, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 75 million adults suffer from hypertension. That's almost 1 in 3 Americans. Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death in the United States. There are millions of lives at stake here. Could there be potential cardiovascular benefits to TM? one of the first to connect the dots among TM, blood pressure, and cardiovascular disease, was Dr. Robert Schneider, a clinical specialist in hypertension, a fellow of the American College of Cardiology, and director of the Institute of Natural Medicine and Prevention at Maharishi University of Management in Fairfield, Iowa. With $26 million in research grants from the National Institutes of Health and elsewhere, Dr. Schneider and his team conducted randomized controlled studies to investigate the effect of TM versus health education. The results were clear. Transcendental meditation reduced blood pressure in as little as 3 months. Other investigators went on to replicate Dr. Schneider's findings, leading to an impressive body of research. Dr. Jim Anderson and colleagues from the University of Kentucky analyzed data from more than 100 TM blood pressure studies involving hundreds of people. Blood pressure changes for those in the TM groups included average reductions of 5 points on systolic blood pressure and 2.8 points on diastolic blood pressure. Their overall conclusion was that blood pressure dropped in all groups practicing TM compared with the control groups using relaxation, stress management, and biofeedback. However, for Dr. Schneider and others, a question remained. Would the short-term benefits on blood pressure also produce long-term gains? To discover the answer, he received a research grant from the National Institutes of Health to analyze the death records of 202 of the participants in his initial TM and blood pressure randomized trials to see if they were healthy and still alive 10 years later. In 2005, Dr. Schneider's team struck gold, finding a 23% reduction in the death rate among those who had been assigned to the TM group 10 years before as compared with those who'd received only health education. On top of that, there was a 30% reduction in death rate from cardiovascular causes. Dr. Schneider then received funding for a clinical trial to compare TM with health education. Once again, TM proved superior. Keep in mind that these people were already ill at the start of the study and were already undergoing standard care, such as medications for hypertension and high cholesterol, and receiving advice about diet and exercise. These standard of care treatments continued throughout the study. After 5 years, the group doing TM fared much better than the group doing health education. In fact, the TM group had a 48% reduction in the risk of dying from myocardial infarction and stroke, as well as from all other causes. In 2013, the American Heart Association looked at the years of research on TM and concluded in its journal, Hypertension, that TM is the only meditation technique shown to lower blood pressure. Besides helping people live longer, there is compelling evidence that TM can help young people who are already highly stressed to live better by alleviating high blood pressure. Vernon A. Barnes, a physiologist at the Medical College of Georgia, set out to examine the impact of TM on cardiac and blood pressure reactivity, which is basically the response to stress, in 35 volunteers between the ages of 15 to 18 with high normal blood pressure. Dr. Barnes divided his subjects into two groups. The experimental group practiced TM twice a day for 2 months, while the control group received weekly one-hour health education lectures over the same period of time. To make the study as true to life as possible, Dr. Barnes also monitored changes in blood pressure, heart rate, and cardiac output in the teens as they underwent interviews about emotionally charged subjects. He also recorded the teen's same cardiovascular reactivity as he or she drove in a virtual reality driving program with built-in stressors. Whether the young people were handling tough topics or troubleshooting obstacles on the road, Dr. Barnes' research revealed that those who practiced TM maintained lower blood pressure than the control group members did. Not only that, but the TM group's blood pressure readings remained lower during periods of rest. Finally, two studies have tested whether TM meditators and non-meditators respond differently to stress by placing two electrodes on their skin to measure their galvanic skin response, or GSR. When you feel anxious, you sweat more, which increases the electrical current transmitted between the electrodes. This is indicated by an upward blip on a graph. Conversely, when you relax, the current decreases, resulting in a corresponding downward blip. Actually, GSR is a major component of a lie detector test or polygraph. In one of these TM studies evaluating galvanic skin response, psychologist Dr. David Orme Johnson exposed 14 meditators and 16 non-meditators to unpleasantly loud noises and compared their GSR responses. In all subjects, the GSR showed an upward blip, but the meditators demonstrated a quicker return to baseline levels. The non-meditators not only returned to baseline more slowly, but they also had more false alarms. They had further upward blips, even when the irritating noise was no longer present. In the other study, this one by researchers Daniel Goleman and Gary Schwartz at Harvard University, the stressful stimuli were scenes of horrible injuries from an occupational safety movie, which meditators and non-meditators were asked to watch. Once again, the meditators' GSRs returned more rapidly to baseline levels. Finally, to return to the pressing issue of high cortisol levels and health, a number of studies have found reduced blood cortisol levels both during TM and post-TM. In one clinical trial, for example, people who had meditated for an average of 3 to 5 years showed a statistically significant 30% drop in their circulating cortisol levels during meditation as compared with controls. Those who had been meditating for 3 to 4 months showed a trend in the same direction, though it didn't reach significance. In another study, subjects who had been practicing TM for a relatively short 4-month duration had lower cortisol levels than controls when they weren't meditating, both at rest and when subjected to stresses such as mental arithmetic or squeezing an isometric hand grip. According to Dr. Norman Rosenthal, the bottom line is that no matter how you measure it, the practice of TM has powerful and sustained beneficial effects on how we deal with stress, which are significant not only in the laboratory, but in the real world, leading to substantial reductions in serious diseases and increased longevity. Jerry Seinfeld told me he's felt the effects of deep rest so profoundly that he likens TM to a phone charger for the mind. The phone charger is pretty tough to beat as an analogy because your phone charger never doesn't work unless sometimes you haven't got it all the way plugged in the outlet, he said. You look at it and say, how come it didn't charge? It's always a little ways out of the outlet, and you go, oh, I didn't push it all the way in, and then it always works. That's the great thing about TM, Jerry continued. You never have to wonder. Let's say you've got a big day, and the night before you say, I'm going to get to sleep early. I'm not going to mess around and watch junk TV. I want to get a good night's sleep. But you're still just kind of hoping. You're hoping that you're going to get to sleep and wake up feeling refreshed. And that's the big difference between sleep and TM. TM never doesn't work perfectly. I agree with Jerry, but I have to add that perfectly is a tricky word. After you've been practicing TM for even a few days, you'll notice that every meditation is different. It's not rigid like the perfect tennis swing or the perfect chord played on a piano. The experience of transcending is fluid, and every session is influenced by the condition of the body at the time you meditate. I like to say, there is no single perfect experience in meditation. There are countless perfect experiences. People sometimes worry that they didn't have the best meditation session. When asked about this, Maharishi used to say, even in a shallow dive, you still get wet. Meditative moment. Better parents and better neighbors. G. Saquon Lawrence is president of Fathers, Families, and Healthy Communities in Chicago. His life's mission is to improve the outcomes of children of non-custodial African-American dads by giving those dads tools to heal broken relationships and live healthier lives. He learned to meditate through a grant from the David Lynch Foundation, and now he's working to make TM a pillar of his organization's service delivery. Here's what Saquon had to say. I work with young men who live in some really distressed communities. I don't want to speak with a broad brush, but some of them have seen real trauma. In the community we serve, there can be as many as 50% of the young men with a record.